Gary levelled the twin-engine Beechcraft Queen Air on her northerly heading and turned in the passenger seat to beckon to Isabella where she sat in the main passenger cabin. She unfastened her seatbelt and went up to the cockpit and leant over the back of Gary's seat. "Okay, Bella, let's hear it. What else can you tell us?" She looked across at Sean in the co-pilot's seat. "Do you remember the night at the Chicumba River when Nicky tried to escape and you and I ran back to catch him?" Sean nodded, and she went on. "You remember the guerrilla officer in the first truck, the one who supervised the clearing of the roadblock? Well, I got a really good look at him, and I knew I'd seen him before. I was absolutely certain of it, but it didn't make any sense. Not until now."
"When and where have you seen him?"
"He was with Ben. And they were going into Michael's farm at Firgrove."
"Michael?" Gary cut in.
"Our Michael?"
"Yes," she confirmed.
"Michael Courtney."
"You think Michael is mixed up in this?"
"Well, don't you think so? Otherwise, what would he be doing with an ANC terrorist commander? And Ben?"
They were all silent, thinking about it for a while. Then Isabella went on.
"Gary, you obviously suspect that Ben has stolen a cylinder or two of Syndex. If he's mixed up with terrorists, how do you think they would use it? Spray it from an aircraft, perhaps?"
"Yes, that's the most likely way."
"Michael has a plane at Firgrove."
"Oh, my shit," Gary whispered. "Oh, please don't let it be true. Not Mickey. Oh, please, not Mickey."
"Michael has been publishing that commie rag of his for years," Sean pointed out grimly. "And he's got very chummy with a lot of the uglies in the process."
Nobody answered him.
Gary said, "Bella, get us each a Coke, please." She went back to the refrigerator in the bar and brought two cans. They drank, and Sean lowered the can and belched softly.
"The Rand Easter show opened this morning," he said, and Gary looked at him. "Well, what the hell's that got to do with it?"
"Nothing,"
Sean grinned at him wickedly. "The Rand Easter Show, the biggest, glitziest show in the country. 500,000 people all in one place. All of industry showing its products. The farmers, the businessmen, every goddamn tinker, tailor and Indian chief will be there. The grand opening this evening at 8 o'clock, the fireworks display and the military tattoo, and the stock car racing and the show jumping. The Prime Minister making a speech, and all the big shots in their dark suits and carnation buttonholes. Hell, of course it means nothing.
Don't fool around, Sean," Gary grated at him.
"You're absolutely right, Gary," Sean kept on grinning. "I mean, at the heart, the ANC are really decent, civilized fellows. Just because they let off a few car bombs and put burning motor car tires around people's necks doesn't mean that they don't have beautiful souls. Hell, don't let's judge them too harshly. A Russian limpet mine in a crowded supermarket is one thing, but they'd never dream of spraying the Rand Easter show with Syndex 25, would they?"
"No," Gary shook his head. "I mean, Ben and Mickey are our own brothers. They wouldn't..."
"No."
His voice trailed off, and then he said angrily, "Damn it, if only we had the Lear, we'd be there by now." The radio squawked, and Gary adjusted the headphones.
"Charlie Sierra X-ray, this is Jan Smuts information. I have a relay for you from Capricorn. Are you ready to copy?"
"Go ahead, information."
"Message reads, all stocks and serial numbers tally. Message ends."
"Thank God," Gary breathed.
"Tell them to check what's inside the cylinders," Sean suggested mildly, and Gary's expression altered.
"Information, please relay to Capricorn. Message reads, take samples from all containers. Message ends."
Gary removed his headphones.
"I want so badly for it not to be true," he said. "But you're right, Sean, they aren't idiots. It would be simple enough to stamp a couple of empty cylinders with false numbers and substitute them in the stockroom."
"How much longer?"
Gary checked his navigation.
"Another hour. Thank the Lord for this tailwind."
Sean looked round at his sister.
"Do me a big favour, sweetheart. Next time you fancy a little bit of nookie, pick somebody a mite tamer, like Jack the Ripper."
The Capricorn airstrip was marked by the gigantic figure of the goat laid out artistically in white quartz. It stood out clearly on the brown felt from a distance of 5 miles. Gary touched down smoothly and taxied to the hangar building where 4 vehicles and a group of Capricorn employees headed by Paul, the managing director, were waiting to receive them. As Gary and Sean jumped down from the Queen Air and turned to give Isabella a hand, Paul rushed forward. "Mr. Courtney, you are right. Two of the small canisters contain only carbon dioxide gas. Somebody switched them. There are 10 kilos of Syndex 25 out there somewhere." They stared at him in total horror. 10 kilos could wipe out an army. "It's time to call in the police. They've got to pick up Ben Africa. Do we have his address?" Sean asked. "Why, I already sent somebody to his home," Paul cut in. "He isn't there. His landlady says she hasn't seen him for the last few days. He hasn't eaten or slept there."
"Firgrove," Isabella said softly.
"Right," Gary snapped. "Sean, you'd better get out there right away. Take Bella with you to show you the way and to identify Ben if you run into him. I'll run things from this end. I'll be in the boardroom. Call me as soon as you get to Firgrove. I'll get police back up for you and raise hell all round. We've got to get hold of those missing canisters." Sean turned to Paul. "I need a car, a fast one."
"I'll take mine." He pointed to a new BMW parked next to the hangar. "The tank's full. Here are the keys."
"Come on, Bella, let's go." They ran to the BMW. "Don't get stopped by the traffic cops, Fangio," Bella warned him, as he pushed the BMW hard along the highway. "We should have sent the cops out to Firgrove before we left Cape Town. God, it's 3 o'clock already." "Or we couldn't do anything until we were sure that somebody had ripped off a couple of Syndex tanks," Sean pointed out. He leant across and switched on the car radio. Bella glanced at him inquiringly. 3 o'clock news," he explained, and turned to Radio Highfeld. It was the third item on the newscast. "Since this morning, record crowds have been passing through the gates at the Rand Easter Show. Today is the opening day. A spokesman for the show committee stated that by noon today, more than 200,000 visitors had already entered the grounds." Sean switched off the set and then slammed his clenched fist against the dashboard of the BMW. "Michael!" he shouted. "It's always the bleeding hearts that are capable of the wildest excesses. How many innocents have been tortured and murdered in the name of God, peace and fellowship of men?" He hit the dashboard again, and Bella reached across to touch his arm. "Slow down, Sean. You take the next exit right." Bella hung on to the door handle as he swung the BMW into the bend.
"Well, how much further?"
"Only a couple of miles." Sean pulled back the tail of his coat and drew the Smith & Wesson from his belt. With his thumb, he spun the chambers. "What are you going to do with that?" Bella asked nervously.
"Ben and Mickey have got nice friends," he said, and slipped the revolver into his belt.
"There it is." Bella leant forward in the seat and pointed ahead. "That's the gate to Mickey's place." Sean slowed the BMW and turned off onto the dirt track. He drove sedately through the blue gum plantation until they glimpsed the buildings ahead. Then he stopped and reversed the BMW across the track.
"Why are you doing that?" Bella asked.
"I'm going in on foot," Sean told her. "No point in announcing my arrival."
"But why are you parking across the road?"
"To stop anybody trying to leave in a hurry."
He pulled the keys from the ignition and jumped out.
"You wait here." "No, not in the car. Hide in the trees over there, and don't even stick your head up until I call you out. Do you hear?"
"Yes, Sean."
"And don't slam the door," he told her as she slipped out of the passenger seat. "Now give it to me. Where does Mickey keep his plane?"
"Behind the house at the end of the orchard," she pointed. "You can't see it from here, but you won't miss it. It's a big corrugated tin shed, all rusty and ramshackle."
"Sounds like our Mickey," Sean muttered. "Now, remember what I told you. Stay out of the way."
He began to run. He stayed off the track and kept the trees of the orchard and the chicken shed between him and the buildings. It was only a few hundred yards to the veranda of the main house. There were chickens clucking and scratching around his feet as he crouched behind the wall and quickly surveyed the building. The front door and all the windows were wide open, but there was no sign of the occupants. Sean vaulted easily over the wall and slipped through the front door. The sitting room and kitchen were empty, although dirty dishes and glasses were piled in the sink. There were 3 bedrooms, and all of them had been recently occupied. The beds were unmade, and there was discarded clothing on the floor and men's toilet items in the bathrooms and on the dressing tables. Sean picked up a shirt and turned the collar. A name tag embroidered in red thread was stitched into the inside of it. B. Africa. He dropped the shirt and ran back silently to the kitchen door. It stood open onto the orchard of scraggly, insect-ravaged fruit trees. Beyond them rose the corrugated iron roof of a large shed, and from a stubby roof mast a sad-looking windsock drooped like a used condom. Sean darted into the orchard and dodged between the fruit trees until he reached the wall of the shed. He flattened himself against it and laid his ear to the thin corrugated galvanized sheet. Through it he heard the murmur of men's voices, too indistinct to understand the words. He checked the revolver in his belt, making certain the butt was at hand for a quick draw, and he eased himself along the back wall of the shed towards the small green wooden door. Before he reached it, the door swung open, and two men stepped out into the sunlight. Ben Africa was good with his hands and prided himself on the quality of his workmanship. He knelt on the pilot's seat of the Cessna Centurion aircraft and tightened the final bolts that held the twin cylinders to the deck in front of the right-hand passenger seat. He had drilled the bolt holes with care so as not to damage any of the control cables which ran under the floorboards. Of course, he could have let the cylinders lie loose in the cabin floor, but that would have offended his engineering sense. There was always a danger of air turbulence in flight that might damage the valve or the tubing. He had positioned the steel bottles so that, while in flight, either the pilot or his passenger could reach the valve handle readily. The bottle that contained element A was painted in a black and white checkered pattern, with three red rings around the middle. Element B was in a crimson bottle with a single black ring. Each bottle was stamped with its unique serial number. It had taken all Ben's skill to forge two ordinary medical oxygen bottles to exactly the same exterior appearance. He had engraved the serial numbers by hand. The bottles were small enough to be smuggled in and out of the Capricorn plant in pockets specially sewn into his overcoat. It had called for ingenuity and immaculate timing to get them through the security check at the main gate of the plant. The bottles were joined by a stainless steel T-piece that screwed into the special left-hand thread in the necks. Ben had turned the fittings on the small second-hand lathe in the rear of the hangar. To operate them, first the taps on each bottle were screwed open, and after that a half-turn on the swinging valve handle of the T-piece allowed the twin elements to mingle and become active. From there the nerve gas flowed under pressure into the flexible armoured hose. The hose led back between the front seats into the rear luggage compartment. Ben had drilled a 3-centimetre hole clean through both of the floorboards of the compartment and the outer metal skin of the Centurion. The end of the gas hose passed out of this hole and protruded 10 centimetres below the fuselage. He had fixed the hose in place and sealed the narrow gap where it passed through the fuselage with Prattley's putty and dried as hard as iron. The gas would spray from below the aircraft well behind the line of the front seats and would be carried back in the slipstream without any danger of reaching the occupants of the Centurion. However, as an added protection, they would wear safety suits and breathe bottled oxygen during the release of the gas. The suits hung on the hangar wall, ready to be donned in minutes. They were commercially marketed full-length protection suits approved by the fire department for use by proto-rescue teams in the gold mines. For a second time, Ben put a spanner on each of the hose connections and the joints of the T-piece to satisfy himself that there were no leaks. At last he grunted with satisfaction and backed out of the open cabin door. He wiped his hands on a piece of cotton waste and went across to the workbench against the nearest wall. The other two men were leaning over the bench studying the map. Ben came up behind Michael Courtney and draped his arm affectionately over his brother's shoulders. "All set, Mickey," he said in his incongruous South London accent. Then he gave his full attention to Ramon Machado. Ben Hero worshipped this man. When he was alone with Michael, he often discussed him with the awe of an acolyte discussing the omnipotence of the Pope. Michael, on the other hand, realized the hideous nature of their mission, and it had taken many months of soul-searching for him to convince himself that this was something that had to be done if the struggle was to succeed. Ramon seemed to sense his lingering reluctance,